welcome to another session of the Seamless Connection podcast. Today, I am thrilled to have with me Dr. Lee Schwamm, who is the Senior VP and Chief Digital Health Officer for Yale New Haven Health System. And he recently took over there as the Chief Digital Health Officer last year. Welcome to the show, Dr. Schwamm.
Hi, Mina. Nice to see you.
Thank you. And before you joined Yale, you had over three decades of time spent over at MGB up the road in Boston. And I know that you've done a lot of great work there, won a lot of accolades, did a lot of transformational work, bringing telehealth, virtual care, other options for receiving care to the community there. Maybe just to start off with, I'm going to hand it off to you just to give a little bit of a deeper dive on your background, both from a clinical perspective, as well as your kind of passion on the administrative side and working on telehealth and virtual care and how that's brought you from MGB to now to Yale.
Yeah, you know, I think that my career trajectory, your career always looks different in the rearview mirror than it does when you're driving on the highway. I started my career in college at university, majoring in philosophy. I kind of thought that I would be a philosophy professor and teach philosophy. And as I got closer to that realization, I thought, you know, if I was the most influential philosopher of the 21st century, like 8 people would read my work and it really wouldn't necessarily have a lot of impact. And having social impact was very important to me. So that's how I ended up in medicine. And I started my career as a neurologist. I graduated from my residency right in the year that, Alteplase or TPA, the thrombolytic drug for stroke, was approved by the FDA. And that was just an enormous change in the way that neurology care for stroke was delivered. And we were completely ill-equipped to manage that. And
why is that?
And well, the reason was that stroke was not a medical emergency really prior to that. For most people, mm-hmm. It was considered, there was a sort of nihilistic fatalism, you know, oh, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. You have a stroke, that's too bad. You know, we'll put you in a dark room and hopefully you'll get better. Not that different than the way we treated acute MI when I first started as a medical student. I mean, literally, there was the concept of controlled infarction. You were having chest pain, you got put in a quiet room, you weren't supposed to move around a lot. And after a couple of days, your pain will be over. And then you'll have 3 years of congestive heart failure. You know, I mean, it was not a great strategy. So a lot of the playbook in stroke is a direct consequence of looking at the playbook in the advances in cardiology for the treatment of acute MI. But so the reality was I could take care of the patients in front of me and leave it at that, or I could start to think about solving the problem for all these patients where I got called from an outside hospital, you know, Dr. Schwamm, stroke service, you know, how can I help you at Mass General Hospital? Oh, I have this patient in front of me. I'm, 20 miles away from you in this hospital over in this community. I think he's having a stroke. They tell me his CAT scan looks normal. He's got some weakness on the right side, might be the left side. Should I give the TPA? And I'm like, I can't tell you that. I can tell you what I would do if he was in front of me and I found this, this, and this, and I explained it and they agreed. And I thought to myself, well, like, why can't I see the patient in front of me over video? That was just before broadband was becoming widely available, but there were little pockets of demonstration projects. There was a program called Global Classroom, which was the idea of a video bulletin board where you could bring classrooms, elementary school classrooms together from all over the country or all over the world, and they could have class together and, you know, have this amazing experience. And it was very rudimentary, but I was like, if they can do that, we can do this. And it's only going to get better, faster, cheaper. So if we can do it now, it'll be viable, you know, for 3 years from now, 5 years from now, whatever. So that was an example of, well, instead of touching the lives of 100 patients, I could touch the lives of 1,000 patients. And then as that model became, you know, first domestically and then globally adopted, that model has impact now on, you know, hundreds of thousands of patients. And then at a certain point in my career, I was like, well, if we can do it for stroke, why can't we do it for neurology, or why can't we do it for other conditions? That's how I started leading our virtual care efforts. And then the final transition for me was, well, why not try to have an impact on as many patients as possible and really rethink how we triage, allocate, deliver care, ensure adherence, and really, you know, finally actually try to meet patients where they are and deliver patient-centered care, which in my career, I don't think we've done very much of. That's a long answer to a very short question.
No, that's a fantastic answer. I mean, you not only clinically, right, but even through your work through the AHA, AAN, ANA, you've been really driving for, like you said, practice guidelines to reach more and more people at every stage. And we can clearly see that through your career progression. So that's fantastic. As you've been building the access to this care, to this virtual care, what do you think has been most important to keeping that patient first mentality that you said that, you know, that's what you're trying to get to? That's kind of the holy grail, if you will.
I think none of what I'm going to say is surprising, but it's surprising we don't think about it. So, you know, one of the interesting things when you do virtual care, you get hit with a lot of criticism from people, skeptics, like, well, you know, the technology to connect with the patient isn't that good. And it makes, what if somebody can't connect? And I say, okay, when was the last time you thought about how your patient was actually going to get to your office and that there was a road closure or that the subway wasn't working or that the parking lot was full? Like, we don't even consider that when we're practicing in-person medicine, but suddenly it becomes a huge, you know, unrecoverable flaw when we talk about virtual. So the first thing I do is I really try to think about patient journey mapping. You know, really leaning on my colleagues in marketing and communications who have understood this for a long time. You want to get a consumer to buy a product or use a product, you have to think about their whole experience from start to finish. You can't just focus on the moment that, you know, they get the steak, you know, delivered on their table in the restaurant. So I think what we have to do and the biggest hurdles have really been recognizing our patients come to this space with very varying degrees of digital literacy and health literacy. And that to support a patient, a virtual patient in the center, requires a lot more complexity. You might need to bring in an interpreter. You might need to bring in a patient educator. You might need a support person for the provider. You might need a technical, not emotional, support person for the patient, right? It gets more complex, so it's a trade-off. The convenience of being able to provide care from other locations and from home, especially important for patients with disabilities, with other impairments or limitations, who are homebound. I mean, that's enormous. It makes a huge difference for those patients. And it's like doing house calls again, like Marcus Welby did, you know, and doctors did for centuries before the modern hospital environment.
No. When you think about the impacts that you've had, obviously you've touched thousands, if not millions, of patients over the last few years and few decades in the various systems and programs you put in place. I want to go back to the telestroke example for a second. When you first started putting together the Get With the Guidelines protocols and the stroke registry, and then working to create the concept of telestroke, essentially, right? It didn't exist, as you pointed out, before then. What do you think has been really important to the adoption of it? Because a lot of hospitals have it, which is amazing when you think about how complex the program is and that the fact that it's a stat response program. We're looking for patients being with the doctor within minutes, not hours, not days. But still, even with that, it's not fully penetrated, right? I think numbers vary for anywhere from 60 to 80%. It's great, but it's not even at the level of radiology. And obviously there's other options to go behind it. So telestroke is one of the leading programs that hospitals have adopted. But if you're working on telecardiology or other options similar to that to impact just as many patients, can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, I think we were, it was kind of a magical moment for telestroke. I'll tell you why. There was a very clear acceptance at some point in that journey that a hospital could not have an emergency room and say it didn't treat stroke. Like before TPA, you could have an emergency room, you could treat heart attacks and trauma and not stroke, and that was okay. Because there really wasn't any efficacious treatment that required you to be delivering a time-sensitive therapy. But once it was proven that these therapies were effective, and all you needed was a CAT scan, an intravenous injection, and an expert, how could you say you don't have that if we could make the expert available to you easily and readily? in a manner that was scientifically proven to be just as valid as evaluating you in person. That just made it impossible for hospitals to say, well, we don't provide that. So once that got established, then there was a lot of anxiety about the litigation risk, the malpractice risk of not having that service available. You had a readily available digital alternative that didn't require a lot of sophistication or complexity to implement. And then you had the added benefit of regional medical authorities or, you know, departments of public health basically taking the position that if you were going to receive patients by ambulance, you had to demonstrate you had this capability. Massachusetts was the first in the country to create an acute stroke service licensure program where hospitals had to license like they would license an OB service or a cardiac surgery service. And to do that, they had to attest to the fact that they had 24/7 access to CT, that they had the drug stocked in the emergency room and formulary, and they had access to stroke expertise, either in person or remotely. I think that was sort of the magic sauce. Plus, you had a generation of young stroke neurologists who were really committed to delivering this therapy and were willing to provide this service. Now, you had to find a way to pay them for it, but they were willing to provide it. And if a hospital has to provide it, renting the time of an acute stroke neurologist only when you need it is way more cost effective than trying to pay for an acute stroke neurologist 24/7.
100%. So there's still hospitals today that don't have on-site or telestroke. What do you think is happening there? Given everything you just said, right? There's a medical malpractice liability. There's a licensure risk.
Most of those hospitals are very small, community or rural hospitals, and they simply just don't have the financial infrastructure and support. It's not that they can't get access to a vendor who would supply it, either an academic medical center in their region, in their state, or a third-party vendor. They either don't have reliable broadband, they don't have the finances, the resources to pay for the time of having this service available. And we haven't really created incentives for those hospitals to make it more affordable. There are no, I mean, the passage of the FAST Act, the Furthering Acute Stroke Treatment Act of 2019 in Congress means that it was now a billable service with Medicare coverage. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it was available as a meaningful offset to the cost for everybody.
Yep. No, it completely makes sense. And as you think about that kind of perfect moment, if you will, what you said in terms of the governments, the states coming together to make this a requirement, the drugs and the processes coming together to make this a requirement, do you see that happening elsewhere in terms of the moment of telehealth? You've worked on many different telehealth programs since then. Do you feel like we hit that trifecta of making it the next natural step for anything else?
Well, I think this was unique in the sense that it was hospital to hospital, right? This was facility to facility. I think behavioral health and substance use disorder had its magic moment during COVID in a direct to patient model that now for most, payers and providers will now be permanently enshrined. So behavioral health will not suffer what's been called the telehealth cliff or the Medicare cliff related to the expiration of the waivers, which is scheduled for December of 2024, unless Congress acts to either continue to extend the waivers as they relate to telehealth from the pandemic era or makes permanent some regulatory relief. I was actually in Washington last week testifying before the House Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee about the incredibly important step that they must take so this does not happen in December, because so many millions of Medicare beneficiaries now depend on the ability to access medical services from their home through telehealth services. But I think behavioral health had that magic moment. Trauma and acute MI require so much technology at the remote end. You need operating rooms, you need, special equipment, you need a cath lab to do PCI. Like, it's hard to think about how to do that remotely, although there is some pretty promising innovation in the space of like surgical robotic technology, where you could do a procedure like a catheter-based thrombectomy or a PCI with an operator located somewhere else entirely. It's kind of science fiction-y, but I think that's an area I would keep an eye on.
Yeah. Now, my brother is a surgeon, does a lot of work on the Da Vincis. And yes, it whether he's in the room right next to the patient or, you know, hundreds of feet away, hundreds of miles away, potentially. I don't think he's done that yet, but the potential is there for sure. And he does it every day. In terms of looking at your role now as Chief Digital Health Officer at Yale, and you did a very similar role at MGB, can you tell us a little bit about what you find the most exciting about that role? Obviously, through COVID, there's been a lot of acceptance that's been accelerated, especially in the inpatient setting, beyond the ED. And I think that's kind of one of the key points, right? That it was previously thought of as just for the ED, just for very acute situations. Can you tell us a little bit more about your role and what you're excited to kind of push for that didn't exist before or that had trouble getting adopted before?
Yeah, you know, Mina, I don't think I realized just how broken healthcare was when I entered it, and, you know, as an intern or as a resident or as a young faculty member. And I think COVID brought that into just like nobody could look at our healthcare system and think it wasn't broken in some fundamental ways during COVID, with how many people died and the disproportionate impact on communities of color and all the social drivers of health. So, but what I think has become even more striking is the challenges with access. We have so many people who need healthcare and simply can't get it. And we have so many healthcare providers who think they're doing everything they can. And yet, if you look at their schedule, not in the rearview mirror, not forwards. If you look forwards, everything's booked, everything's full. If you look backwards, there's lots of holes in the schedule. There's lots of slots that went unfilled. That's in part because our system is so complicated. Our triage mechanisms are so antiquated, and our billing and prior authorization so onerous that we can't cycle that appointment back to availability fast enough. So I think there's a huge opportunity to really help so many people get the right care at the right time. And that has several different flavors. Flavor number one is my goal is they should not have to call me to figure out who I would recommend they see. Right? I get a lot of phone calls. My brother's sister-in-law's neighbor's gardener, you know, needs to see such and such. Can you help? You know, because they want to know who you would recommend. Well, we know enough about our providers and enough about our patients that we should be able to make that match.com experience without having to talk on the phone. And so one of the things we're building now that I'm super excited about is a sort of next generation AI-enabled provider match or provider search and recommend that I think is going to be game changing. We're going to talk to patients about what their problem is, and then based on that, match, extract those concepts, and then match that concept to a taxonomy we've derived from what providers are actually doing, what they're actually seeing based on their claims, their procedure logs, their notes, and say, if you have multiple sclerosis and you're 18 years old, Mina is an MS doctor who spent 80% of her patients are under the age of, you know, 25. That's the person for you. And she sees patients here, here, and here, and this is when she's available. And if she's not available, here are five doctors like Mina that other people like you picked when Mina wasn't available. You know, like that, that's, you know, Amazon.com sort of meets healthcare. That's one really huge thing. The second big thing is, why do I like to say my car gets better healthcare than I do, right? My car tells me when it's running low on gas, right? I don't have to wait till it's out of gas. It tells me when the engine oil needs to be replaced. It warns me before the engine overheats. Instead of ending up on the side of the road with smoke pouring out of the car, well, that's what happens in healthcare. You end up on the side of the road with smoke pouring out of the car, which is your acute MI, your stroke, your hypertensive urgency, your asthma exacerbation, whatever. So remote patient monitoring and, you know, autonomously powered monitoring of you to make sure you're on your care plan, that you're adhering with your care plan, and warning me before you fall off your care plan so I can get you back on track before you have an adverse event. That to me is moving from this discontinuous episodic encounters to more of a continuous embrace in healthcare. That to me is another major shift that we can make. And then the last thing is, why don't I explain to you what I learned about you, what my plan is for you, and what your test results showed in your preferred language at your level of literacy in a manner that is actionable for you? Like, why do I just tell you it in my words, which I'm mostly using to convey to other doctors? Why aren't I in parallel making that available to you in a way you can really digest meaningfully? And then lastly, I'd love to talk to you as a patient like we're doing now, face to face. I'm not typing. I'm not looking over here at some computer screen. I'm looking at you. And so ambient listening with clinical documentation support is the next big thing that we're introducing. We just introduced it last week at Yale with a company called Abridge, where the clinical conversation between patient and provider gets turned into a structured medical note that can be edited and saved in Epic, in our electronic health record system. That's the stuff that really excites me and that could have such a huge impact on so many patients.
That's fantastic. One of the things that seemed to be a commonality through all of these initiatives you mentioned is they seem more focused on the outpatient setting. Do I have that right?
Well, that was the sort of the, that was when you talked about impacting the largest number of patients possible. Yes, we also have some really exciting inpatient stuff where I don't think we've really had a digital inpatient experience that's been, you know, deeply considered. I can tell you the hospital room that I walk into today looks an awful lot like the hospital room I walked into 30 years ago. And with the exception of clipboards then and, laptops on wheels now, rounds is pretty similar as well. And so there's a lot of opportunity there to, again, move away from discontinuous random intercepts where I come in your room in the morning and I might swing by at some point later in the day just because I'm walking by your room. But you spend 90% of your day alone in your room with nobody looking at you. We need to move to a more continuous model of observation through novel sensors, edge computing, predictive algorithms of who's at risk for falling, you know, who's at risk for a clinical deterioration. We just put in an algorithm that looks at a variety of 120 different variables, I believe, in Epic to predict who's at risk for a significant deterioration in the next 24 hours, meaning death, cardiac arrest, or transfer to the ICU, usually for sepsis. Well, we want to couple that with a video-enabled rapid response. So that status bar goes from green to yellow or green to red, meaning you're at high risk for a deterioration. Within a few minutes, I should have a nurse, a very experienced nurse, beaming into the bedside in a wall-mounted audio-visual interface where I can take a look at you, maybe take a look at you with the bedside nurse who may be less experienced than I am, and make a decision about whether this algorithm is highlighting something concerning or, you know, the patient's brushing their teeth and their heart rate went up because they were brushing their teeth because the, you know, EKG is rattling as they're rubbing their toothbrush, in their mouth. So I think that's an incredibly important opportunity. I think the bed and the room are increasingly going to become a digital hub, and we'll be able to transduce all sorts of additional signals that we maybe didn't before, how much they move on the mattress, what their temperature is across their body, not just when we measure it once a day behind their ear. All sorts of ways that we could leverage what I often call digital exhaust. There's all this health data being generated, pouring off of us, and we just let it disappear and go into the atmosphere instead of digesting it and making it actionable.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because everything you mentioned, there are so many discrete data points right there. And health systems, as you've seen across two very complex ones, sit on a lot of data today already. And to your point, they don't necessarily do something with that data and taking those insights. Some do at the very top end of that range, but most have a lot of data they're sitting on that's not actionable upon. How is the best way to make that data useful to your point of what do we do with it? What does it mean for the patient? How does that help cut length of stay? How does that help reduce readmissions if they're on the ambulatory setting? How does that help reduce progression?
Or reduce hospital-acquired infections. I think what we've done, which is the first and important enabling step, is we've started to create systems to transduce that data. But as you pointed out, we don't need more data. We need more information. So we need to figure out how to condense and then in a very efficient manner compute all those different multidimensional data into a framework that allows us to have an impact on measurable and evidence-based outcomes that are valuable to patients and valuable to the health system. And I think the advances that we've seen in computational technology and methods with artificial intelligence, machine learning, is really the first time we're going to have the power to do that. Traditional statistical methods can't absorb the amount of data that we need in real time to help us with these tasks. We have to use different forms of artificial intelligence that can synthesize enormous quantities of data very rapidly and give us fairly discrete, relatively small amounts of data that can be stitched together and stored easily as part of our medical record. We can't store continuous physiologic data on 1,000 patients a day in a medical record. It doesn't make sense and it's not viable. What you can do is synthesize that data and reduce it, transform it down to a relatively small number of actionable variables that can then be incorporated into decision logic.
No, and that makes perfect sense. One of the other areas that everyone talks about these days, like you mentioned, AI, machine learning, all of that, is the concern on the flip side of when you do use that, you know, incorporating that into your EMRs, incorporating that into decision making without potentially having a human check at some point in the future, right? What are your thoughts there, and how aggressively are you moving towards that kind of future?
This is a very hot topic, I'm not sure we even know enough to debate it properly, but we certainly know enough to raise some red flags. So I think that for much of patient-facing healthcare, we're not ready for autonomous agents to act on our behalf. I just don't think we're quite ready for that. In the back office, it's already happened. I mean, there are prior authorization claims that are being submitted. There are billing claims that are being submitted that are completely autonomous because they're very rote tasks and they're based on very explicit rule sets that leave very little room for interpretation. So, yeah, there could be some haywire activity there, but it's very limited. And I think the risks are very low. We're not ready for a machine to make a radiology diagnosis without human intervention. Let me share a somewhat concerning study with you. Well, there's two of them. The first one is a study done out of Emory that looked at chest x-rays and trained a model to say, here's the chest x-ray, here's the race of the patient. Learn the model. Now here's a new set of x-rays. Tell me the race of the patient with just the chest x-ray. Model performs incredibly well. That's creepy. Okay, let me start filtering out the features that maybe are contributing. The angle of the ribs, the size of the heart. Let me get to the point where the x-ray looks like a block of gray metal with no distinguishing features whatsoever. Model still performs incredibly well. So we don't know how a lot of these models work. We really don't know what they're seeing with the machine eyes that we're not seeing with human eyes. So that's a really important piece that we've got to try to figure out how to solve for. Now, next is the area of cognitive bias. So there's something called computation bias, which is if the machine says it's true, it's probably true, even if it's patently not true. This is why people drive into the middle of a lake when they're following their GPS. Yeah. Even though they can see the water coming, somehow the machine says, keep driving, you know, due north for 2 more miles. If I say to you, how much is 220 times 340? And you write it down and you try to figure it out. And then I show you on a calculator that same equation, you will defer to the calculator. Right? Because you've decided it's got to know better than I do. You know, my hand, longhand arithmetic, I might have made a mistake. So another study in radiology, they took an algorithm that was trained to rate mammograms for the risk of likelihood of breast cancer being present. It's called the BI-RADS. And it's a score, I think it's 0 to 4. And they trained the algorithm to make this prediction. And the algorithm actually works very well. and they gave the algorithm to support the readings of three groups of readers. Inexperienced readers, like their residents, experienced readers, general radiologists, expert readers, mammographers. All they read is mammography. And not surprisingly, algorithm is very strong. Everybody performs about the same. When you give them the algorithm, the inexperienced readers are looking like experts. It's amazing. But then you give them a new training, a new data set to read, and this time you deliberately program the AI to give the wrong answer. Like you make it give the wrong answer. Whatever your answer is, add one or subtract one or whatever. Well, not surprisingly, the inexperienced readers, they drop. Their performance is terrible because they're just following the model around blindly. The experienced readers, they also drop a modest, you know, modest amount. The experts, they still drop about 50%. So even experts, have a deterioration in their performance because of that computational bias. Now, then people said, well, that's because no one knows how the model is working. Show them how the model is working. And if the model's getting it wrong, they'll know that. And so then they'll, you know, they'll be fine. And this is a model that looked at heart failure, pneumonia, or COPD as the cause of the patient's symptoms. And they showed you the chest x-ray and they give you a heat map on the chest x-ray that indicated where they were making their decision. And when the model is behaving appropriately, they show you the lungs for the heart failure, and they're showing you that, you know, they're focusing on the fact that the heart is larger in the chest and that the edema is more at the periphery versus when it's pneumonia, it's more like, you know, central and lower or whatever. Then they make it the wrong answer and they show you totally implausible hotspot, like the diagnosis of pneumonia, and it's on the sternum. The hotspot's like on the chest wall and the bones and nothing to do with the lungs. They still defer to the model. So explainability doesn't eradicate that influence of computational bias. So the answer is we're going to need to be vigilant in a way that we've often shown we're not very good at. We get accustomed to the machine and we start to rely on the machine and we get a little lazy. So I think that there is real risk here. And the risk has to do with confidence, vigilance, trust of the machine versus an awareness that the machine can mislead us.
No, 100%. One of the things we've talked about, or we haven't talked about so far, is we've focused on the patient and their experience and how we can make that better. One thing we haven't talked about is the other side of that equation in a virtual care scenario, which is a remote provider, whether it's a nurse, whether it's a doctor, whoever it happens to be. One of the key reasons telehealth has not been beloved, if we'll use that language, is because of that soul-crushing burden, that soul-crushing administrative burden of telehealth, whether it's the various logins, whether it's the various systems, it's not standardized, it's not easy to use, and it's not efficient compared to how they're used to practicing. What are the things that you see as the biggest roadblocks to get more remote providers or more providers willing to practice telehealth in a way that we need to reach all of these patients that need access to this care?
You bring up a couple of important aspects of variability, variability in care. So if you're a orthopedic surgeon, you go in the room, you probably have had an MA room that patient. You might have a nurse or a nurse practitioner following you around, writing your note for you. You are just like walking in, doing a few exam things, talking to the patient, going to the next room. That is going to be very hard to replicate in a virtual environment. But if you're a pediatric endocrinologist, you might be going out and rooming the patient yourself, checking their vital signs yourself, doing the whole thing, arranging their follow-up before you send them out of the office. So part of this is how do we make the virtual experience comparable for the provider to an in-person experience where the details of navigation do not fall solely on them, where they have the same chaperoned experience they would normally have. The other is, we've had the privilege of having telehealth be reimbursed at the same rate as in-person care by Medicare for the last 3.5 years due to the pandemic. That will likely go away. I think it's likely that telehealth will be reimbursed at a lower rate, hopefully not much lower, because Medicare rates are pretty darn low to begin with. But if the rate is 50% of an in-person visit, who's going to cover that gap? The health system? I'm running out of money. The practice? My colleague who's seeing people in person? Like, how are we going to do that? Because otherwise, you know, that will basically kill adoption. So I think we have to really understand, what are we trying to accomplish with our healthcare dollar? The more we move into risk-based or value-based care models, then it becomes very easy. We've already been paid for the care. So however you can do it in the way that's most effective, going to lead to the best patient outcomes at the lowest cost, is going to win. So in a single payer environment or in a risk-based model, I think telehealth has an opportunity to grow. But we also have to get really thoughtful about when is it clinically appropriate, and how do we think about when and with what degree of certainty I'll be able to accomplish your needs over telehealth. If I've seen you, I'm a neurologist. If I've seen you in the office, examined you, sent you for an MRI, and the follow-up visit is just really to walk you through what I found, explain the diagnosis and what the treatment options are, I can do all of that over telemedicine. That's a given. But if you're coming in with a lump in your breast or something in your abdomen, I can't evaluate that over video. And so we're going to have to get better at triage. We're going to have to get better at getting more information upfront autonomously before we decide whether you're appropriate and need a physical exam that can only be done in the office, or whether it can be done remotely, or whether we can disassemble the visit. Oh, it can't be telehealth because she has to have a chest x-ray before I see her. Well, let her have a chest x-ray at Chest X-Rays R Us in her neighborhood and have it sent to you before the visit, and then you have it, and then you can do it all at once. We got to get more creative about how we assemble the visit to make the experience feel comparable or, quite frankly, better. And you know what? For some providers, it's really nice to be able to see a patient at 8, at 9 o'clock, not see anyone, go take your kid to the bus to get them off to school, come back and see your next patient at 9:30. You can't do that in the office. You can do that from home. We need to think about provider satisfaction, provider burnout, flexibility in the workplace, and telehealth can help us accomplish some of those goals, again, if we support it well.
Yep. No, 100%. And one of the things that you mentioned there's a lot of pieces that you just talked about that need to come together to be able to handle that kind of patient triage. We like to call it red light, green light, yellow light, right? From a neurology perspective, migraine, sure, I can do a lot of that virtually, but a new onset Parkinson's, maybe not so much. And so having that for each specialty, each reason for, you know, for consult, all of that takes a lot of time.
You know what, Mina, let me push back on that for 1 second, though, because I've asked my colleagues in movement disorders, and by the way, the Parkinson's docs were some of the first to really pick up doing televisits. What's better when you're titrating a patient on Sinemet, you know, levodopa with new onset Parkinson's? What's better, seeing them once every 3 to 6 months for half an hour, or seeing them for 5 minutes a day, 6 times in the course of the first 2 months? There's no question. It's better to see them frequently for brief periods. You can't make a patient drive 2 hours to come in and see you for 5 minutes, but you can make a patient log in for 5 minutes. We don't have good reimbursement models to value what I just said at the same or higher than that 30-minute visit, which is how I get paid. So I see you every 3 months for 30 minutes because that's how I get paid. And if we had the right mechanism for doing the other, we'd be delivering better care.
Yep. No, especially you see the difference in how people practice when it's a risk-based model and they own that risk versus based on outcomes versus a fee-for-service. So yeah, 100%. One of the things you just mentioned in the previous answer was all the different components that go into delivering this smooth, comprehensive care. As chief of digital health, both here and at MGB previously, well, who are all the stakeholders you had to work with and wrangle, really, I'm sure, at some points to get to where you needed to be to make that program work?
A lot of people, a lot of moving parts. What I would say is it was kind of bimodal, because prior to March of COVID, you know, We were going out and beating the bushes for volunteers, right? This was, we were doing some self-funded activities. We were, you know, paying the docs a modest amount of money to cover the cost of these visits at a lower rate than they would have gotten normally, but at enough of a rate that we held the docs whole. We didn't keep the practice whole, but we kept the docs whole. And, you know, we saw people who were loved technology or who had patients who had a really hard time coming in, you know, or had diseases like Parkinson's where they wanted to see them frequently, or ALS, where they deteriorated, you know, over time and they stopped being able to see them after a certain degree of their illness made them really homebound. And now they could keep seeing them. You know, so there were groups that self-identified. I knocked on a lot of doors and I was told, this is not for me. There's no role for this in my practice whatsoever. Don't bother. COVID comes, all the clinics shut down. You know, why aren't you giving me this service? You know, so compared to nothing, we had a lot of adoption. We had 90% of our 10,000 adopters adopted in 6 weeks. That was our whole early, middle, late adopters, 6 weeks. And our never adopters, like there was a tiny portion that, you know, like still hadn't adopted out, you know, at the 6 months. We looked at it by age, race, this, that, the other. We looked at generations, you know. The only group that didn't adopt or adopted in a very limited way was the silent generation. Those are the ones like born before like World War I. I mean, you know, like it was, they were like in their 80s and 90s. I mean, at MGH, we actually had enough of them to have a cohort, but, you know, everyone adopted. And then you can see people backed off. And the groups that didn't back off are behavioral health, neurology, these facility-based things like telestroke, and then little pockets. In pediatrics, some pediatric subspecialties, you know, really got engaged with this. We had a great program with children, adolescents with autism spectrum disorder. You know, being in the office is just chaos for them. It's so stimulating, it's overwhelming, and they love doing visits, you know, from their computer or their iPad from home. You know, that was a huge success. We just finished a large randomized clinical trial in palliative care, looking at telepalliative care versus in-person palliative care for advanced stage lung cancer. That'll be presented at ASCO in the fall. That'll be one of the largest randomized trials to date, looking at comparing a telemedicine intervention to an in-person intervention. So I think the answer is that you need the patients to be bought in and not feel like this is second class care, you know, like substitute care. You need the docs to be bought in and you need the payers to be bought in so that the patient doesn't feel like they're paying top dollar for something that is quote unquote less. The further you get geographically from the health system, the more economically sensitive the patients are, the more they value this service. So if you're-
Which unfortunately can be completely opposite, right? They're more economically sensitive, but they need it more.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is for some people in professional roles, they're salaried. So if I skip a day or an hour to go see the doctor, I don't get paid less. And if I do have to pay for parking or gas or whatever, it's a trivial component of my expenses. If you're a wage worker and you don't get sick time and you have to take, you know, a half a day off or a day off from work to drive or take the bus and change three times to get to the doctor, right? That's an enormous burden. Those are the people for whom telehealth has the most to offer. And those are the groups that we need to create the incentives for and the capacity for them to be able to do telehealth.
100%. What are you there's most excited project. About? That you
oh, sorry. Just there's a great program that colleagues of mine just presented in a symposium that we host every year on virtual care of turning public libraries into telehealth spaces for communities where individuals don't have access. It's a perfect blend, right? You've got technology experts in the form of librarians there. You've got space, yep. You've got broadband, you got privacy.
Yep.
It's kind of magical.
Yeah. I've heard about that. I think it's in Montana or Idaho, where they were looking at creating little pods where doctors could reach out to patients to do that. But I know we're coming up on time, but one thing I wanted to close with is, you know, in your new role, you've been working on, you highlighted a couple different initiatives across a different, not a spectrum of areas. What are you most excited about? And, you know, a year from now, what do you think, you know, your role and Yale overall as a health system is going to look like different from it is today?
Well, that's sort of like asking which of your children do you love the most? I'm excited about all of them. I really am really excited about all of them. I think the conceptual, rather than answering about a specific program, I think true digital transformation is what I'm the most excited about. I'm not excited about taking a simple analog process and digitizing it. Doesn't add real value. I mean, it may make some things a little more efficient, but that's not where the value comes. The value comes when you actually look at what are you trying to achieve? How did you try to achieve it in that other way? Now, how can I make it bigger, brighter, faster, easier, or actually do something you couldn't do before because now we're doing it digital? Telestroke is a great example. There was no way to treat those patients any other way. If they tried to drive to you, then they wouldn't get to you in time, right? You couldn't drive to them and get there in time. It's this magical moment in time, and you've created something new because of telestroke that didn't exist before. So to me, that's the exciting opportunity. How do we transform the care we're giving so it doesn't look like what it used to look like, but it's so much better, right? Remember buying an airline ticket? Maybe you're too young, but you had to wait online for hours to speak to someone, or you had to go through a travel agent, and it was complicated, and you really couldn't, you had to just sort of tell them what you wanted. They told you what was available. Now it's great. You go online, you see 18 different airlines, all the flights, nonstops, one stop, cost. You can sort however you want. That's amazing. Amazon shopping experience, those are amazing experiences. I want to make healthcare feel like that. Like, oh my God, this is great. Instead of, oh my God, this is terrible. This is overwhelming, or I have no idea what I'm doing.
That is such an amazingly refreshing, and actually no one said it like that to me before, in terms of it's such a new way to think about virtual care and healthcare, as I want to see something new that hasn't been done, as opposed to that kind of that incremental step of making it better, like you said, transforming analog to digital, because most people, quite frankly, that I've seen are working on that, right? They're working on ways to make analog to digital versus something that's completely different and a leap year beyond what's being done today. So that's exciting.
I'll end with one analogy. You know, when they first started, when television first was created, they had everybody on a stage, like they used to be on a stage for a play, and they put a camera in the audience and they bolted it in place and then they did what they used to do, right? That was the first, you know, that's the equivalent. That's that conceptualization of, I'm just going to digitize what you're already doing. And now think about, you know, handheld cameras, multiple cameras, the camera as an unreliable narrator, you know, the camera moving while the person holds still, right? We've totally broken that frame. And now we do things with cameras, the Matrix, right? All those different cameras to create these amazing special effects, bullets, you know, freezing in midair and people leaping and jumping. And that's what we need to do. We need to reimagine healthcare so we're not just pointing a camera at our old stage where we all go through the same motions. We're doing stuff that just was unimaginable before.
Which, tying it back to what you started with, that is really hard to see looking forward, but it seems so obvious when you look back. And so I'm really excited to connect with you again, maybe in a few months, maybe in a year, to see what was that digital transformation for this year that really came through. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Schwalm. Happy Bye. Friday. Hope you have a lovely weekend, and looking forward to talking again soon.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much, Mina. Have a great day.